Should I start?
Just resuming the interview with Mitchell Grubler for the New York Preservation Archive Project.
I lived in St. George, Staten Island, and one of its very special places is a 19th century development of houses, some designed by the architect Edward Alfred Sargent. And he had a sort of unique stamp to his buildings. There are certain characteristics that kind of made them special, built in the 1880s, 1890s. And there was a whole concentration of them on St. Mark's Place, which is where I also lived. And one of the events that the Preservation League sponsored that I was involved in was held at a Greek Revival building called the Pavilion on the Terrace. And I invited homeowners from historic districts in Brooklyn that were similar, with large single family houses, late 19th, early 20th century, to talk about their experiences with getting landmark designation and their experiences after designation as a way to rally people to advocate for a historic district in St. George. And it did result in finally getting the New Brighton, a historic St. George New Brighton Historic District, which is now, very proud of. You can see the pride that people take in their homes. And interestingly enough, Marjorie Johnson was one of the members of the Preservation League, whose husband was a descendant of the architect Edward Alfred Sargent. And so she had in her collection a lot of Edward Sargent's original drawings, including some for the houses in St. George. And she brought them out and showed people some of them. They recognized their houses in a couple of cases. And so that was a great resource.
Can you tell me about the, I guess the scene socially in Staten Island? What, in terms of your own kind of personal transition to a new part of New York City?
When I moved to in 1978, I had actually a brother and sister-in-law living on Staten Island, but I didn't know very many other people, although I did become friends through the Preservation League. But I also learned that there was a gay organization on Staten Island, Lambda Associates of Staten Island. This probably maybe in the early 80s. So I would go to meetings and dances and made friends there. And got involved in certain projects, like running a Halloween dance at a building that was the old Liberty Theater in Stapleton that had become a disco. And it was fun. Dressing in costume and decorating for the Halloween event, and having a, they had a stage, and we had a costume contest. I also got involved in their participation in the annual Gay Pride Day march. And I would speak about it, make flyers to distribute to get people to attend, because it was somewhat of an effort to get Staten Islanders into Manhattan. I had a banner made, and this is a photograph with the banner. I also learned that the workers at the ferry made a float, this huge model out of metal of the Staten Island Ferry. And somehow they agreed to lend it to us. I found somebody with a Jeep who could pull it. And they lent it to us. We decorated it, and they lent it to us for the parade. And that was a great, great rallying point, great hit, and certainly, you know, great representative of Staten Island. And this organization was special in the sense that both men and women were sort of equally involved, which wasn't the case with many Manhattan organizations at the time.
That's true. Why do you think that was?
Well, Staten Island's a small town. You don't have that many varied, you know, you don't have that much variety of organizations. And I guess both men and women were looking for that kind of community experience.
Were there any other people who were involved in preservation that were also part of the Lambda Associates?
Not that comes to mind.
Well, can we talk about becoming involved with the Alice Austin House?
Yeah. At my first job out of the University of Vermont, out of the preservation program, was at the Staten Island Historical Society. And part of my duties as assistant to the director was filling orders for photographs from the collection. And the Staten Island Historical Society owns the Alice Austin photography collection of both glass negatives and some prints. So that's how I first learned about Alice Austin and about the Friends of the Alice Austin House. They would meet in Manhattan, and I would go as a representative of the Staten Island Historical Society. And that's how I met Anne Novotny, who wrote the biography, Alice's World. And it was on occasion when I think I might have been in a car with Anne Novotny that she asked me, was it clear to me that Alice Austin was a lesbian? And she told me about interviewing gay friends of Alice Austin and about her life with Gertrude Tate and some things that were not included in the book.
Can you talk more about her decision to exclude some of those things and I guess how this...
It's only speculation on my part that maybe it wasn't acceptable to the publisher. I mean, if you read the book today, I think most people would realize that Alice Austin had this 55-year relationship with Gertrude Tate. I believe she does say it was a loving relationship. But that's that aspect of it. My other involvement before I worked at the Alice Austin House, this is, by the way, these meetings that I went to were before the house was restored and opened to the public. When I was involved as president of the Preservation League, the borough president had allocated like $1 million to restore the house. And there was this all-volunteer Friends of the Alice Austin House group. Peggy Buckwalter was sort of leading it. And all of a sudden, the house was ready, and they really didn't know where to go from there. So I spoke with Peggy Buckwalter, and together with the Preservation League, we sponsored a program to open the house to the public with an all-day event with the architect and the man who specialized in the faux finishes and wallpaper choices and some other craftspeople involved in the restoration, to give a program. And it was a great success. A lot of people came out that day, and it sort of introduced the public to the house and its restoration.
Sounds like it really focused on the house itself.
It did.
Rather than, let's say, as opposed to Alice, the photographer.
Right. Well, I was so that was my early introduction to Alice Austin. Then I was working as assistant curator at the Staten Island Institute of Arts and Sciences, I knew the. Well, some occasion involved with that, I met the director at the Alice Austin House, and she was leaving on maternity leave, and said they were looking for someone to step in. I applied for the job and was interviewed and was offered the job, and to me, that sounded just fantastic. I knew about the house, I'd been involved, and I knew the whole story, and it just felt right. And I enjoyed the work very much, offering. You know, it's a small historic house. We didn't have a large staff, although I did hire a part-time education person and a part-time collections manager. I did some wonderful exhibitions where I was able to use my creativity. One was called The Larky Life, and it was about her photographs playing tennis and riding a bicycle and all those aspects of this life that she led as a young, energetic, fairly well-to-do family, coming from a fairly well-to-do family. And I did an exhibition together with the Preservation League of Staten Island, there was an exhibition of her photographs together with a contemporary photographer's photographs of the same buildings. Like, well, it's gone now, but there was the S.R. Smith Infirmary built in 1890, which she photographed in 1890 at its opening or shortly after its opening, and then a contemporary photograph of it. Then there was an exhibition of she traveled to the World's Columbian Exposition in 1893. So we used her photographs, which we made enlargements of, together with, I found this collector of that World's Fair, all kinds of memorabilia and ephemera. We used her photographs together with all of this three-dimensional material. That was, I think, 1992. Little did I know that, you know, most of what went on for that commemoration of Columbus would be Columbus bashing instead of more positive commemoration. But I planned it in that way.
And how did, I guess, Alice's lifestyle or life with Gertrude come into play when you're planning exhibitions or, you know?
Well, in 1994, they were commemorating the 25th anniversary of Stonewall. And there was a fellow by the name of Fred Wasserman who was holding these community meetings in planning the commemoration, involving all kinds of institutions, art institutions, libraries. He was working on an exhibition that came to be called Becoming Visible. Yeah, I think that's what it was, at the 42nd Street Library. And I went to a meeting at the Gay Community Center on 13th Street and met him and said, "You've got to include Alice Austin." And I felt this was a way that she could be, the whole entire scope of her life and story could be better known without sort of jeopardizing my position, because I knew that, you know, the board at that time had some homophobic members, was very hesitant to acknowledge that aspect of Alice Austin's history. And it came to pass that he used two or three of her more obvious, you know, female photographs. I knew the local arts editor, Michael Frizzola, and he wound up putting it on the front page of the arts section, "We're Here, We're Queer, Get Used to It," with a big, you know, spread about the exhibition and Alice Austin. And that didn't sit too well with the board of directors.
Can you kind of describe, you know, this exhibition, Becoming Visible? You know, to me seems a big part of that is claiming people and saying these people were important cultural producers, and they were also gay, they were queer. On the other side...
Well, a lot of the people included in the exhibition might have been openly gay. whereas Alice Austin definitely was not.
Mm-hmm. Can you help me understand who the friends of the Alice Austin House were and the board of directors? You know, who are they claiming her as? What's their stake?
Ironically, the president, not when I was hired. When I was hired, the president's name was Howard, I forget his last name, and he was great. But they changed presidents over time, and there was a president by the name of Jim Thompson, who happened to be a closeted gay man and wrote, you know, after this exhibition, wrote to the local newspaper, the Staten Island Advance, a letter which was published denying that Alice Austin was gay. What happened was we would do a nautical festival every year out on the lawn which faced the Narrows, New York Harbor. And there was a group called the Lesbian Avengers at the time. They were very creative. And they came dressed in those swimming suits like that are depicted in some of Alice Austin's photographs, where they covered the whole body, swimsuits from, I don't know, 1890s or so, and inner tubes. And they made up all these sea shanties, but with words about Alice Austin and Gertrude Tate. And they came for protests, which got covered by the local press. And there was one board member who was particularly homophobic, carrying on, challenging me, what am I going to do about it? And so that got coverage in the press also, and that sort of galvanized the board against telling the whole story of Alice Austin.
Can you...
Things are different now.
Yeah. Can you maybe recall what your... Well, I guess, what stance did you take? And how formal of a stance did you have? You know, thinking back to the layers of history, you know, that you were taught. Are you arguing that this part of her life should be part of the house at the time, or are you stepping back and letting the board decide?
Well, you know, I was employed by the board, and it was at their discretion to keep me or not keep me. So I was, you know, walking a fine line. So I thought that the way to do it was to have Fred Wasserman and the exhibition out Alice Austin in that way.
And they didn't agree with that.
No, they were not. Well, you know, especially with that cover of the art section of the paper, I don't think they were very happy with that.
Sounds like a very difficult position for you to be in.
It was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did you navigate through it?
Well, eventually I was asked to leave. Mm-hmm.
And what was that? What was that like for you? What was the impact of that?
It was dramatic. Yeah, I mean, there were some days I would work till 11, 12 o'clock at night because I loved the job. And I felt that I really made an impact on making the history of Alice Austin and her photography better known, the historic house better known, increasing visitation, doing substantial classroom visits, having an impact on the general public. We would do things like, there were a series of photography classes for the visually impaired. There was a local senior residence, and so some of the seniors participated in a photography workshop where they actually took pictures. And if you think of a black and white photograph, what is it made of? It's made up of shading and shapes of dark and gray and light, which is often what visually impaired people can see. I had a guidebook to the house published. You know, one of the wonderful aspects of Alice Austin and her photography is that she took her camera and photographed every room of the house. So we had this record of what the rooms looked like. And we used those photographs. I hired someone to write it and select photographs to publish a guidebook to the house in Alice Austin history using her original photographs, because some of the rooms no longer looked like what they did when she lived there, and they were filled with her collections from world travels and her Uncle Oswald's oriental vases and other items. And using her photographs gave people a sense of what these Victorian interiors looked like at the time that she lived there. Then she also took her camera into Manhattan and photographed people on the streets of Manhattan selling pretzels, sweeping streets, selling suspenders, all kinds of street people. And so I did, she actually, we don't know if it was for sale. We think it might have been gifts for friends. She made up these portfolios of photographs of these street types, which she called Street Types of New York. And we, the Alice Austin House does have one or two in its collection. So does the Historical Society. So I did an exhibition, Street Types of New York, including some other photographs that were not part of the portfolio, but were of that subject matter. And for sale, made replicas of her portfolio photographs, which won a National Historic Trust publication competition.
Wow. How public was, your firing from the Alice Austin House? Was there kind of a visible controversy?
You know, I knew this arts editor, and I was alerted to the fact that the president, this closeted president, went to him, which I thought was very malicious. And, I said to him, you know, look at all the things that I've accomplished. And I outlined some of the things I just said. And so his article about my leaving, instead of being this negative kind of thing that this home, this closeted president one turned into a much more positive article about all of my accomplishments during my term there.
And was there any sort of, I guess in a more private sense, was there any sort of, I don't know, did the lesbian Avengers come to your aid? you know, I'm just thinking.
No. That you know, there was an oral history, and someone from the 11th Avengers got it wrong. They said that the director was the homophobic one. It was the president who was the homophobic one.
Right. I think what I'm getting at is just the contrast between today and when you were going through this experience, you know, right?
Well,
now,
I have to
finally in the Supreme Court, there's discussion around is there protections?
Well, I have to give credit to those that came after me, not directly after me, because I think the director directly after me was not in favor of, you know, telling the whole story of Alice Austin, and neither was the board at that time. But I have to give credit for those who managed, both board members and staff, who managed to come to the point we are now, where it's a major aspect of the interpretation of the Alice Austin house, Alice Austin's life, and Alice Austin's photography.
Did you see that?
Maybe I had some role in laying the groundwork for that.
I think you surely did. did you see it start to turn towards being more open to being truthful about Alice's life from afar, I suppose.
Yeah. At one point, there was a president of the board who was a lesbian. I don't know how out she was. And then, you know, eventually they hired, I think he was openly gay, director, and I guess at that point things changed.
And can you talk about the way that the house is now, the interpretation that opened recently?
I haven't been to see the new exhibit yet, but I intend to see it on Saturday.
Oh.
Which is the Staten Island event marking coming out day. And it's at the Alice Austin House.
Amazing. You'll find that the Larky life continues on. It's still part of the exhibition.
Uh-huh.
I was there last month, so I've seen the new exhibition.
While I was at the Alice Austin House, there was a project to nominate properties associated with the history of women as National Historic Landmarks. And so while I was there, there was a National Historic Landmark designation, and we had an event to celebrate that. It was a dinner on the lawn with entertainment and a presentation of the bronze plaque.
That was in 1992, is that right?
Sounds right.
So it was actually under kind of a rubric of women's houses, you said?
Sites associated with the history of significant women. Yeah.
And that's how the house.
Yeah, it was a. I think the National Park Service contracted with some organization that did the research throughout the country, maybe, and to, you know, did a nomination of a whole bunch of sites.
Was 92 the year of the woman, or whatever that was? Do you remember that?
I don't
I'm know. Wondering what the intersection was here. Do you have any stories about working in the house? As you mentioned, sometimes you were there late at night, but I'm just wondering about the place itself.
Yeah. You know, the earliest part of the house, some people think is 1690, some people think is 1710. I think it's more likely 1710. Anyway, we were in the house. It wasn't late at night. There was a nor'easter. And, you know, the house sits right close to the edge of the water, although up on somewhat of a rise. And there was a television in the room. That's the earliest part of the house. And that room, the ceiling, are these huge beams and a low ceiling. When you sit in that room, you get a sense of its history. And the storm was getting more active and all, and I don't remember who I was with, maybe with the secretary. And there were chairs because people would watch the video in that room. That's why there was the TV. We had it on, although I don't know that the reception was very good, and they were predicting this pretty powerful nor'easter. And I'm looking around at the beams, and I'm thinking, this house has stood for, what, 250 or more years? We're not gonna be in trouble in this room. The other story that I like is actually from Anne Novotny's book, Alice's World. And in it, she talks about Alice Austin's grandfather, whose house this was, and his wife making a trip to Europe. And I don't remember if they were in Great Britain or they were in Germany. I think it might have been Great Britain. And he met a young couple, and they said, oh, we're making our first trip to America next year. And he said, well, when you come, my house is the first one on the left.
Wow. I guess that could be true, in a sense.
Well, there were actually one of the other projects was a walking tour of Alice Austin's neighborhood, which is now called Rosebank, used to be called Clifton. And some of her friends had houses of a later period along the shore, even south of hers. But it's still a great story to tell.
Yeah. Not many people can say that. And so what are your thoughts about it being a landmark with LGBT significance now?
I think it's great. I think it's a great example for young people. I think it's, you know, great that we have a national historic landmark that commemorates a same-sex relationship. But more importantly, at the heart of the matter is not only the historic house, but the photographs that we were lucky enough through a set of unusual circumstances to still be stewards of, to still have. And so it's important that we learn about how the photographs may have come about because of the whole life story of Alice Austin, including the fact that she loved this woman, Gertrude Tate, and how that life influenced the making of those photographs.
That's a very apt description.
And every year now they have, except for when it rains, and let's hope it doesn't on Saturday, they have Coming Out Day at the Alice Austin House.
Kind of celebrating, it's never too late, I guess.
And the current director, Victoria Monroe, is doing a great job.
I want to talk about your work also in Queens. So can you explain the transition to the Queens Historical Society from the Alice Austin House?
Well, there was a time period between. But I was looking for work. I'm not sure. Someone I know by the name of David Goldfarb, who lives on Staten Island, may have learned about an opening for director, executive director of the Queens Historical Society. And I applied for that job and was interviewed, waited a while, and then was contacted and offered the position. I didn't know a great deal about Queens, but I certainly knew how to be an administrator of a not-for-profit history organization. It's in, they're located in a historic house, Kingsland Homestead. And so I went into the position with a good background and experience in that sort of thing. Not to this quite the same degree because we had other people on staff, but I was involved in exhibitions for the 35th anniversary of the Queens Historical Society. We did 35 treasures from the collection, and that ranged from a bronze plaque in German that was once mounted on a monument to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory workers that were killed in the fire. And I used my connections with the Parks Department, and they came and cleaned the bronze. It had a sign from Rockaway Playland, which had a sort of mascot of a clown-like face on it. A bookcase from about 1750 that I was able to have restored together with several other pieces of furniture from our collection. A flag from about 1812, which I had a conservator mount to be part of the exhibition. I tried to do some programs that would involve outreach to the Asian community in Flushing, because that's where they're located. they met with some limited success. But we did lots of public programs. Another aspect of my tenure there was upgrading the school class programs. I hired a consultant, Jane Cowan, to create a school class program that involved worksheets and a craft project that students can take with them. And that met with a high degree of success.
Did you continue living in Staten Island during that time?
Part of the time, yes. Yeah, so my commute would sometimes, with public transportation, my commute would sometimes be over 2 hours, taking a ferry and the subway. But then I moved here.
Okay.
And there was a van that goes from here to Flushing.
You hit the jackpot. I read in an article that when an article about you transitioning to the position as the head of the Queen's Historical Society, that what attracted you was the socially conscious members of its community, Queen's community. And I'm wondering if you know, if you found that to be true, if there was more community engagement in Queens than you had found in Staten Island.
I did get involved with the longtime president of the Queens Historical Society, and the one who hired me was Stanley Kogan. And he was involved in preservation, but then got even more involved by founding the Queen's Preservation Council. And its emphasis was on Queen's history and historic preservation. One of the preservation battles that I was involved in was the Bound Street Community Church, built, I think it was 1899, with some Tiffany windows, but the congregation was opposed to designation. And it sat in a sort of limbo category for quite a few years. It was calendared, so we had some protection. And eventually it did get designated. Another preservation issue that's still not completely resolved is the Brinkerhoff Cemetery in Fresh Meadows. And we all went and testified at the Landmarks Commission. And finally, it did get designated. However, the city did something years back that it never should have done, which was sell it to a private owner. Cemeteries are not supposed to be city-owned cemeteries, or even private cemeteries, not supposed to be sold. And this private owner has so far not been willing to sell to the city, even though the city is at a position now that they've agreed to buy it. So it's in an overgrown state. You know, it would be nice to get in there, clean it out, and see what remains of any stones, and better care for it as a sacred site and a historic site. The Brinkerhoffs go back to the 17th century. And we know that there are Brinckerhoffs and descendants interred.
Can you maybe talk more broadly about reasons that you've encountered for people to really resist or oppose historic designation?
Well, you know, one of the things that comes up is in our capitalist democracy, you know, property rights are often held sacred. So people oppose what they feel is any taking of those property rights. How dare you tell me what I can do with my building or my property? Then there is this often misconception that it takes more money to do the kinds of work that the Landmarks Commission requires. It's not always the case. It may be in some cases, but if you do it the right way in the long term, it's often a greater savings. Religious properties sometimes feel that it's against the what amendment is it for the freedom? Freedom of religion? Basically, I think that's what comes down to. The other thing is, and this is sometimes a misconception, is that people feel it's a way that leads to gentrification. Although studies have shown that that's not really the case.
What have you found? Have you found there to be different attitudes in the different boroughs that you've worked in?
I think Manhattan is a bit more savvy, and you've got a lot more organizations and people involved in preservation in Manhattan. I think there's still a lot of opposition in the Bronx, although they've made some progress. Back, 2 years ago, there were the 95 properties that had been calendared but never designated. And the Landmarks Commission, through pressure of preservation groups, agreed to hold hearings. Many of those properties were removed from the calendar and not designated, I think, because of people's opposition to landmarking and political opposition. I mean, there are council members in Queens that are very opposed to designation, and they, you know, landmarking has to go before the city council to be approved now. So I guess, you know, the other boroughs sort of, there's a lot of progress made in landmarking in Brooklyn. Brooklyn is becoming a lot more like Manhattan in certain ways. But Queens and the Bronx and Staten Island still have a ways to go. And a surprising number of properties in Queens and Staten Island were removed from calendaring without designation.
Thank you for that bird's eye view. So can we talk a little bit about the Queen's Preservation Council?
Sure.
You touched on it a little bit in terms of its focus on preservation, but I believe it also had bringing together of organizations, many organizations. So can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, we meet monthly in Queensborough Hall. It was founded by Stanley Kogan. And at a certain point, he was no longer in the picture. And they asked me if I would chair it. And I agreed to. We have representatives from local Queens historical societies. Parkway Village Historical Society, for example. Queens Historical Society is represented. People from Woodhaven, from Richmond Hill, from Elmhurst, from Forest Hills, from Bayside Historical Society. And one of the things that is very timely is that together with the Four Borough Neighborhood Preservation Alliance, we meet with the chair of the Landmarks Commission periodically to review a list of properties where requests for evaluation have been submitted, or if not, we know that there's a file on a property or a potential historic district at the Landmarks Commission. And that's coming up. Our meeting with the chair is coming up next month. And these are landmark priorities of ours that we want to know the status of.
Can you talk about the impact of development in Queens, just maybe over the years that you've been chair, and how that has impacted the preservation work that you're focusing on?
Well, I know that the community of Jamaica has been rezoned, parts of it anyway, and it's undergoing a lot of development that is threatening some of the historic properties. There's also a Central Queens Historical Society, and people there have been more on top of Jamaica issues. It's an uphill battle for a lot of people. The people in Richmond Hill have been trying for a historic district for many, many years, and so far have not been successful. Although there are a lot of people, owning turn-of-the-century houses that have been, restoring them and love that community. I don't know what else to say on that matter. They've tried for a historic district in Astoria, where there are also Victorian houses, and they've been unsuccessful there.
A lot of places, I think. Like you said, an uphill battle. Can you talk about deciding to move here and the work that you've done in this neighborhood?
Sure. Well, I have a lot of friends in Manhattan. And I did a lot of things in Manhattan, even living on Staten Island. And I realized I should be in Manhattan. So I put my name on some, waiting lists, and after 23 years, this one came up. And, it has been my practice when I lived on Staten Island and now here to get involved in local preservation issues. There's a former nursing home on East Broadway, the Bialystoker Nursing Home, which closed. And I learned about it. Got together with a colleague of mine that I knew on Staten Island who also moved into this area, and another colleague, and we formed the Friends of the Bialystoker to advocate for its landmarking. Members of the community opposed it, came up at the community board committee meetings. And at one meeting, even the union for what were the workers opposed it. But we met with George Arts, who's a political consultant, and he advised us to meet with the union, and the union backed off. They didn't come out in favor of landmarking, but they also backed off in opposing it. And eventually we did get it designated a landmark. And it's, of course, the nursing home residents are scattered hither and yon. It's no longer a nursing home. The building is saved. There used to be a saying, how can you tell a landmark in New York City? And the answer was, it's the one with the tall building or the skyscraper next to it. In many cases, although not this one, it's because they bought air rights. But in this case, it was sold to a developer and it will be apartments with a new building built next to it. But at least the building is there. Then I learned about the Bowery Alliance of Neighbors. And since I live on the Bowery, it was a natural. And we did get a number of Bowery buildings landmarked, although it is on the state and national register. But there's no New York City Historic District, and every time you turn around, there's another building going for new construction. But we did get the Germania Bank building designated and 357 Bowery, which was a German insurance company headquarters designated, and 97 Bowery, which is a cast iron fronted building. And several others. The bank across the street, the old Citizens Savings Bank. There's a case where be careful for what you wish for, because right next door is a 28-story building.
Where do you find the energy to, I guess, enter into what often becomes many different battles in favor of protecting buildings?
In many cases, they make for the variety of the streetscape. They're our patrimony. I think of them as a gift from previous generations. They represent historical periods of history. They re represent particular people. that are important to commemorate and celebrate. And they contribute to our lives today. You know, I do a lot of walking, so I walk the Bowery a lot. And I don't want to see glass and steel buildings. I want to see architectural elements. I want to see balustrades. I want to see carved lintels. I want to see stone ornamentation. I want to see elaborate pressed tin cornices. That's what makes life varied and exciting. And if you have to change the use or rehabilitate the interior, fine. And it becomes part of our life today. And once it's gone forever.
It's true. Looking back over your career, is there anything that stands out as being something that you're most proud of? You know, whether it's a structure or a district or even something that didn't really pan out, but something that you feel strongly about looking back?
Well, I'm proud of the work I did at the Alice Austin House, and making it better known, and, you know, providing education and enjoyment to thousands of people. Same at the Queens Historical Society. I'm proud of exhibitions that I worked at the Staten Island Institute of Arts and Sciences. We helped a little bit with the Olmsted House on Staten Island when I was with the Preservation League. I'm proud of walking tours that I worked on for the Preservation League, house tours. I'm proud of the St. George Historic District, which I played a role in coming about.
Well, I think that might be all my questions. Is there anything else that you think you might want to add that we haven't talked about?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.